Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Peter Mason.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Stone from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show, and looking forward to bringing you a few more topics under discussion today. It's always good to share those with you. We also have one special guest from the world of football, and I'd just like to say a very big thank you to everybody who downloaded the last podcast, because on the first day that we posted it, it had the second highest amount of downloads of any podcast we've put up on one day. So that's really great, and please keep your feedback coming. If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss, share it with us via our Facebook page or even via the website page, which is notthefootyshow.com. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, John, it's good to be back, and the news that probably a lot of your sporting fans have been waiting for is the Hockey World has announced their new Pro League. It's been, I think, 3 years in the making, and they've announced the teams that will take part in this global league, which is going to be named the Pro League. And in the women's competition, it will be Argentina, Australia, China, England / Great Britain, Germany, India, Netherlands, New Zealand and the USA. And in the men's competition, the nine teams are Argentina, Australia, Belgium, England / Great Britain, Germany, India, Netherlands, New Zealand and Pakistan. And Pakistan are going to be playing their games in Scotland. Now, first of all, we've discussed this before. I do have concerns about this league. I think the timing of it probably couldn't be worse, because I don't think the money is there in global sport that there was, say, 5 or 6 years ago. So it's going to be interesting to find out where the money comes to support this. We've seen Super Rugby struggle to have a competition over, what is it, 5 continents, and this one is going to be over 9 countries. And I think that could be really difficult. The FIH have said that they spoke to 600 stakeholders over a period of time, and this is a tournament that's going to follow the sun. It's going to run for 6 months of the year, and there's going to be games every week, 144 live games being shown on television around the world. And Jason McCracken, the CEO of the FIH, when he made the announcement, said that if it's not live, there will be streaming available. So let's hope that they've sorted that out and things are not geo-blocked as we've suffered with the game before. And it's part of the hockey revolution. They've been putting it in place for 4 years now. And so it's going to be really interesting. The concerns I have is, how are they going to pay the players? Because the key thing is 6 months, games every week for 6 months all around the world. These guys are not going to be able to have jobs now. They are not going to, it's going to affect their university studies, because they're going to have to go to Europe, say, for 3 weeks. But also, if you look at the men's competition, with Pakistan now playing in Scotland, that means there's an extra or a sort of southern hemisphere or Asian team, or a team from the eastern side of the world, is now playing its games over in the west. So there's an imbalance when you're trying to plan the scheduling. I also worry for Pakistan as a whole. We know that here's a country that's not been allowed to play games back at home. They've been struggling financially. They've actually been taking money out of their junior programs to support the senior men so that they can maintain their world rankings. Now they're going to be playing all of those games in Scotland. I'm thinking, how are they going to make money out of this? Unless there is a sponsorship deal which sees the money go back to them. So that really worries me. But it's going to start in January 2019 and run through to June. There will be a grand final at the end of it. Again, we need more information. Is that going to be a two-leg grand final, home and away? How will that be decided? Will the team that's top get the home advantage for the second game? So there's still a few things I think need to be ironed out. The other one, last thing I want to say, John, is England / Great Britain. Now, we know what that is. They know that, obviously, when it comes to the Olympic year, they want to play as Great Britain so they can bring in players from Wales or Scotland to play in that team. But to me, in a competition like this, it's either England, it's either Scotland, it's either Wales. It's not Great Britain, or you play the whole time as Great Britain. I don't think there should be the option to be playing as England or Great Britain.
Well, just on the Great Britain part of things, Great Britain's technically an associate member. Great Britain's has their own special category under the FIH categorisation of how members are sorted out, and it's so that they can have the Olympic exposure as Great Britain. But it's England Hockey Board is a member of the FIH. The Wales Hockey Board is a member of the FIH. So I'm not sure
and that's why
how
I
they
feel
can justify
that
it.
Should, but yeah, exactly. That's why I think it should be done that
absolutely
way.
And on Pakistan, it's a real pity they, especially considering Malaysia is not going to be playing in the new league, that why couldn't they have played games out of Malaysia? It strikes you as being a pretty clever thing to do, considering that they're both Muslim-dominated countries, essentially, and the Pakistanis would have had no problems fitting in into the Malaysian environment. It's going to be a lot different moving to Scotland.
I find it bizarre. Exactly. That was my immediate reaction, was why are they not playing in Malaysia? Because also, if you look at the sort of agreement that has taken place between Pakistan and Malaysia, where Pakistan has had trouble to develop players, Malaysia has taken a lot of their young players and they play in the Malaysian Hockey League. So there is a really good understanding between the two countries as it is. And I thought that was a logical thing, and I find it very, very strange that suddenly they're being made to play in a European country when, as you say, are they going to get many fans in Scotland that are supporting Pakistan? Whereas if Pakistan played in Malaysia, yes, they would get fans.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I thought the whole idea of this league competition, when I sat through, you know, the meetings of it in London a year ago, and we were told that the key provisos were you must have a television broadcaster. Well, are Pakistan TV going to be filming it in Scotland? Maybe they are, but that's a huge cost as well, because they're going to have to pay higher rates of pay than they would if they were playing in Pakistan and possibly Malaysia. The other thing you had to have was guaranteed crowds, and I'm just wondering how many people are Pakistan playing in Scotland going to attract as opposed to Pakistan playing in Malaysia?
Three quick points. First up, television rights. No professional sport in the world, or I should say all professional sports in the world, run off television rights. The NBA is not the NBA unless it has a television rights deal. Same with the NFL. Same with Premier League soccer. Take away the television rights deal and Wayne Rooney isn't getting that bigger pay packet anymore. So that's number one. That's the most important thing they should have been concentrating on, is making sure they can get a decent television rights deal. Now, at a quick glance, it appears as though that's going to be problematic to draw all of those different streams together. To get different broadcasters on different continents to try and work together is going to be terribly, terribly difficult. And the success of the competition will rest on the amount of money they can get out of broadcasters. Number two, what are you going
to... Can I just say on that one, because I think, to be fair to the FIH, I think they have made a lot of headway with that.
Yep.
For example, they've already locked in Star now. It's no longer a global deal. They are now their partner in India. They have BT Sport in the UK as a partner, and they've also signed up a German company, I can't remember the name of the TV station, as a partner there. The FIH already has a partner in the Netherlands. So I think they've got all of those things, but as you say, it's going to be dovetailing all of those independent ones. The one that concerns me again is Fox over here. As we know, Fox has had the rights for hockey, but it has opted not to show the games live, but show them at strange times, at night or in the morning. So I think if you're going to have this deal and it's a global deal and you're promising the fans this coverage, you have to ensure that the games are shown live.
Absolutely. Secondly, payment to players. Now, we've already seen situations in the Indian Hockey League where Indian players, they only have to be paid $2,500 US. Now, these teams are full of blokes who are getting seriously good cash in the tens of thousands of dollars to go for their six-week hockey tournament, and their teammates are getting $2,500 for the same amount of time and effort. Now, it's not going to take the players long to figure out what's going on. They're all expected to perform at the same level. They're all expected to do the same amount of training and travel and all of those other things, whether they're playing for India or Australia or the Netherlands or whoever they're playing for. So they're going to have to come to some deal with the players where there's equity and pay for all of the players. They won't be able to continue with this Indian Hockey League model for payment, because that will just collapse. The players will walk away.
Well, this competition now puts the Hockey India League in real jeopardy, because that runs normally for the month of February. This competition is going to run January to June. So what I've heard as well is the HIL teams are saying, well, they now want to only sign players for 2018 on one-year deals. And a lot of the players are going, I'm not signing a one-year deal. If you want me, I want to lock in for two, you know. And some obviously would like a bit longer. So now I think this competition puts the hockey in. When is the Hockey India League going to be played? When is the Sultan Azlan Shah Cup going to be played? And, you know, it just worries me that you, and the other thing I think in the background that nobody's discussed is if you look at an Olympic year, most of the international teams do not want to be playing any games, depending on when the Olympic Games are. If the Olympic Games are going to be in July, they do not want to be playing international matches from about April. They want that calendar clear, that they just keep all the players under cotton wool so the best players are fit for the Olympic Games. So what are you going to do? If the Olympic Games are July, August, and this competition doesn't finish until the end of June and you've got a grand final then, I think a lot of these nations are not going to be happy because they don't want to be playing that late into the calendar in an Olympic year when the Olympic gold medal, that is the pinnacle of the sport.
Get to that in a sec. Another point I'd like to make about the World League is we've got, what, nine teams named in the men's and women's?
It's the Pro League.
Pro League. Yeah, Pro League. I'll get that, tap that into the head, Pro League, Pro League. Now, the point I was trying to make was that in the Pro League, what's the relegation system? Or have they just created these eight or nine teams are going to be playing in this wonderful World League, having this fabulous competition against each other? Well, how do the rest of the hockey nations improve if they're not playing against the best? Is there going to be a relegation system? Are countries going to be given the opportunity from outside of the World or the Pro League to join it? Are they thinking about expansion? I don't think there's anything in the press release about expansion in the future, is there?
I haven't read anything, and I agree 100%, and I know Austin Smith, you know, the captain of the South African team, having worked with him on television, I spoke to him, and he was in London last year. That was the question he was asking members of the FIH. What happens to South Africa if we're not in here? How are we going to improve as a nation? And where is the encouragement for, as
Absolutely.
You touched on, Malaysian Hockey Confederation to invest in their team if they're not part of this number one competition in the world? Why should their government or why should sponsors come on board if they're not getting the exposure because they're not part of this competition? So you're running the risk of actually seeing those lesser nations fall further away than they are at the moment from the top teams. And I think you need to have, absolutely categorically, a promotion and relegation. The team that finishes bottom should drop out, and the top team, if they're going to, I believe they're keeping the World League going, and that's why I was correcting you. So the World League that is taking place at the moment will continue, and so the top teams in that will then play off to qualify for World Cups and Olympics so that those second-tier teams will still make it through to the major tournaments. But then why can't you have the top teams in the World League win the promotion to the Pro League?
Well, you've got to have something like that. Otherwise, there's no real incentive for anybody to compete. There's, what are we going to get out of it? We finish top of the next 128 nations, but you... seven or eight or nine at the top there, you're sweet. You've got your cash cow. And don't forget, if this whole thing works out and it does make money, then those nations are going to be sitting on a huge financial advantage over those nations that aren't in the Pro League.
The thing that concerns me as well, John, and I've spoken to people from various countries when I've been at tournaments on this very thing, and I've been told that by one body that it will take them 3 years to make money from being a part of the Pro League. Now, again, is that good administration? Now, we've criticised administrators. So just like the Super Rugby, where they expanded that and they put teams into that, the AIU now is trying to cut it back because nobody made any money from it. Now, are those administrators that have worked out that they will not make money in the first 2 years, they will only make money in the third year, are they being responsible? Are they being irresponsible? And how do the fans and the participants in the game feel about that?
Look, I don't think you can go into a venture like this and think that from day one it's going to be a huge cash cow. I think a venture like this, it's going to take two or three or how many years. And if they've factored that in and they understand that, then I don't see a problem with it. It's if they haven't factored it in and they're running around telling everybody, oh, we're going to be rich, we're going to be rich, that's when it's going to be a problem.
But then looking at that, so do you agree that then maybe if there wasn't relegation, that there's a sort of... hold on that for the 3 years, so those first teams can actually recoup their money. Because imagine if one of those teams that we're talking about that said it's going to take 3 years for them to make money, they get relegated after year one. They're going to be in a parlous financial state.
I think the FIH is going to have to dig into its pocket. I think they're going to have to support these countries and the players and the officials and everybody else that's trying to make this work. I mean, it's being imposed by them on us. So I think there's a duty on their part to make sure that no one misses out. And let's face it, the FIH ain't short of a dollar or two, are they?
I'm not sure. I don't think they're quite as wealthy as FIFA.
They might not be as wealthy as FIFA, but if they can afford helicopter rides for executives, they can afford to make sure that the players and officials are paid properly, can't they?
You would think so.
Now, one final thing on the Pro League. What worries me is this Pro League's being set up specifically to counter the fact that the Olympic Games will no longer be the number one tournament in hockey. That the Olympic movement is desperate to cut back the numbers. They want hockey to cut back to sevens or nines or whatever.
Fives, I believe.
Fives, which is even worse. I mean, that makes it a joke of a competition. And I just wonder if they maybe wouldn't have been better off trying to maintain hockey as an 11-a-side Olympic sport, because that has for 100 years been the blue ribbon standard for hockey, is the gold medal at the Olympics.
Well, the announcement's due, I think, in the next few weeks, isn't it, as to which sports will be there for 2024.
I mean, in some ways, hockey might be better off not associating itself with skateboarding. Nothing against skateboarding, but, you know, Olympics.
Look, I have to say I agree with you in a very big way. I think the Olympics, sure, the sporting landscape has changed and we have seen a lot of other sports, but to me, the expanding of the Olympics has gone the wrong way. I would have liked to have seen it just sticking to those sports that were there. In fact, a condensing of it. I think we've kind of made it just get too big, and it's just too cumbersome now, and you can't keep across all of the sports now in an Olympic Games because there's just too many of them. And to be fair, we've criticised the TV stations that have broadcast the Olympic Games over here, but they are really between a rock and a hard place, because how can they keep those Taekwondo fans happy when they're showing athletics, and then they've also got to show kayaking, they've got to show all these different sports, gymnastics, and, you know, it's very difficult to give everything to everybody.
What staggers me is that hockey as a sport has global reach, 137 nations. It's a huge sport. It's the second biggest team sport in the world. We have a situation where in Australia we can watch MotoGP live on free-to-air television. Now, if I walk down the street, what's the chances of me bumping into someone that is a hardcore motorcycle fanatic? And what is this chances of me bumping into a hockey player? Now, the Pro League, they can set it up, they can do everything that properly that they possibly can. They can just nail everything. But if people don't turn up, if the hockey community does not get behind it, it will go nowhere. And it's up to the people, hockey like me, who follow the game and who love the game, to turn up and support these events. It's no good the FIH just putting them on and us going, oh, wow, isn't that fantastic beauty? I'm off down the pub. We've got to go to these events and support them, and that will ensure its success as much as anything the FIH does.
Well, that was one of the criteria. They wanted full houses to watch these games, and that's why they're putting a calendar in place so that everybody knows when the games will be, where they will be, which I think that is good. I think hockey really needed that, because the Champions Trophy was at different times. Aslan Shah was at different times. Everything was moving around, and they needed to have a rigid hockey calendar. So broadcasters knew, commentators knew. I mean, I'll ask you this, John, and this might be a bit of selfish interest, because obviously I do commentate on the hockey. But I worry as well that, to me, if you listen to certain sports, like the sport we don't mention on this show, Dennis Cometti and Bruce McAvaney, instantly are two names that I link to that sport. You know, I look at Dan Maskell with tennis. He's no longer with us, but he did Wimbledon for so many years for the BBC. I listen to cricket, Richie Beno, Ian Chappell, Bill Laurie. Immediately are names that spring to mind.
Simon Hill.
Yeah, Simon Hill with football.
Yeah.
You know, Martin Tyler with football.
Yeah.
And I just think, again, are they going to have a voice of hockey, or are they going to go with independent commentators in each of these nine countries, which, again, to me, will lose... I'll put my hand up, say this may be a selfish interest, but I just worry, and if they don't choose me, it doesn't bother me, but I just think hockey needs to have a voice that is synonymous with the game, because at the moment it doesn't actually have a universal voice like a Richie Beno or Hasha Bogle or whatever, where everybody goes, bang, that voice is that sport.
No, good point. And it's they've got a lot to go through yet, the FIH. They've got a lot to sort out. Obviously, they've been working on it for 4 years. I'm sure they've crossed as many box ticks as they can. It's all proof will be in the future, and it's all coming in front of us.
Well, we'll have to wait and see.
Hi, I'm Willie Miller, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you're indeed listening to Not the Footy Show. It's now time to turn our attention to our guest on this podcast. Now, those who follow the local game of football here in WA will have noticed in recent seasons a real emergence of a club that's been around for a while but has never really achieved anything on the football landscape. And the club we're talking about is UWA Nedlands. Now, they've started playing a brand of football that has got many people talking. They may not have won the Division 1 of the State League, but certainly everybody in that league is saying that they are playing some of the best football and they're really developing as a team to watch. So we thought it would be interesting to catch up with their technical director, who happens to come from Germany, and just find out what is going on at the club and the reasons for their success. And their technical director is Gerhard Janssen. Gerhard Janssen, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Hello, Ashley. Thank you for having me.
Well, the reason we're catching up with you is you're the technical director for UWA Nedlands, and a lot of people around the football scene in WA are saying they're noticing the changes. I think it's always been very much a varsity football club before where they've had a bit of fun, but it looks like now you're actually going places. What do you put that change down? Is it a change of mindset?
Yes, it's mainly the change of the philosophy, which came in with Michael Janssen as a coach of the first team, changing around the structure and the playing structure. I think it took us a good 12 months to implement this, but it was easier because we kept all our players in the club. So
that was amazing to hear that you kept every player from last year. I mean, what did you put that down to? Because there's always a player who's chasing a trophy somewhere and will go to a higher bidder or whatever.
Yes, and some of our boys did the same, but they came back. So they did this for a couple of weeks pre-season. And I think what convinced them is, firstly, I think mainly Michael's training, Michael's structure, what they learned. The boys can see it on the ground. They feel it during the training. And it is the togetherness in the club. I think that is a big change. I'm in the club for a couple of years in other positions, and I see how the boys stay together, what they do socially, and how Michael organized that everybody feels first team and reserve. We have 48 players in first team and reserve, but everybody feels to be part of something big growing.
The one thing I find interesting as well, looking at your involvement and Michael's, you're both from Germany, and football has always been in this country. People always throw this ethnic tag along, and we've seen Italian clubs, Macedonian clubs, Croatian clubs, but a lot of the sort of coaching has a sort of British bias, let me say, or there is an Italian bias with some of the clubs as well. But obviously a lot of the other ethnic clubs I mentioned, they don't have those players now. They're not made up of 11 Croatians or 11 Italians. But have you brought any sort of German structure, because the Germans are renowned for that, to the club?
Oh, I think, yes, it's part. And this is why I said it took 12 months. It starts from punctuality and being part of training and understand that we don't learn during games. We learn during training sessions. And I think Michael's training sessions are of high quality. Michael is educated and in the university for football. And that is a little bit of difference to that, what you see overall here in Australia. And I think the game plan is absolutely different, yes. I think you can see on Saturdays a philosophy on the pitch. I think that is mainly not only keeping possession. I'm not a fan, and Michael is not a fan of teams who play possession for possession's sake. It is more high efficiency combined with a possession game. And I think this is typical Germans for the last 15, 20 years.
Germany's been very successful on the world stage. Again, are you taking some of the structures that German football have put in place and the way they look at developing those players to bring them through to international level? Are you adopting some of those on a lesser scale here?
I would say yes. I think Michael's experience in even being part of the national women's under 16 squad gives us a good basic for that. We start with that in the under 12 and bring this through the ranks. It will take a couple of years to see the fruit from under 14, 15, 16 coming through. But in the first team, I think it's very, very visible that Michael's idea of having connected the parts of the team, so we are not playing 11 at one time, not 11 players are involved in the game at one time, but the connection between defense, midfield, horizontally and vertical, things which Michael constantly trains, and the boys learn this, and it takes a while.
We talk about developing players. I mean, are you focused, or Michael focused, on developing their skills, or is it developing the formations that teams are playing? Because there seems to have been, with the Dutch influence in Australia, so much emphasis on formation and a style of play that we've actually lost players learning the basic skills. And if I look, heading at the moment in Australian football is diabolical.
That's something crucial. There is no formation on the pitch under German understanding, and when you look at the different styles that German Bundesliga clubs play and the styles Jogi Löw even plays, so he changed four times the formation in the last 12 months, and because he makes a formation as a tool when he has players with special abilities. So by improving the player individually and his tactical ability, single tactical ability of a single player in his position to the right and the left, that means a horizontal in his part midfielder and vertical in front of him, striker behind him, defender, that is something we have to improve. And when you look into other leagues, higher leagues, NPL or A-League, that is where most of our top talents struggle.
There is obviously a case, and now if we look at it, the FFA are wanting the A-League clubs to be the sort of nurseries for players. But hearing you speak and having looked at some of the developments at UWA Netherlands, I question whether some players are actually better off staying in a club like yours and that they will develop. And again, it's horses for courses. Do you agree that certain coaches will suit certain players?
Of course, yes, of course. Like in Germany, the versatility of coaches is important to press a whole nation in one system. And it is a story. It's not true that all Dutch people and all Dutch clubs play 4-3-3. When you look at Rotterdam this year becoming Dutch champion, they never played this. They have a total different way of playing this. The national team, because it's dominated by Ajax Amsterdam for many, many years, did this for a while, but they even change again and again the system. So I think stereotypes are not helping football. And we need to develop every single player in the youth time, and we must make them fit enough to adapt to a coach when they come to the first team. But you can only do this when you give them the chance to play many, many different positions, systems, and interact with your players, because they think they play a different game when after some years they come into senior football and the coach changed, and the coach changed the system. Then they lose their footage, they don't know what to do, because they learned 15 years to run up and down because somebody told them you are a right winger, and right wingers must be quick, small, and stay on the line. And that's definitely not how we develop players.
There's a lot of merit in what you say, because Damien Murray, who was the greatest goal scorer in the NSL, when he first played in Melbourne, it was interesting that his coach, when he was a teenager, made him play as a defender. He goes, because to be a useful striker, you have to understand how a defender thinks. Do you agree with those philosophies?
100%. 100%. And there are many, many examples. Nowadays, the people look at Mats Hummels as one of the best centre defenders in the world, and he played till under 18 centre striker, and Bart Stuber the same. I can go through this. In the youth development, you must take away the pressure to win and play in leagues. On one hand, on the other hand, you must give the boys the opportunity to play in different position, because what can you lose as a coach? If you play him one, two games in a position where he's not suitable, okay, then you don't speak about it, bring him back in another position. If you suddenly clicks and he plays 10 times better, you're a genius. So as a coach, you can only win. But you see this here, that the coaches don't do this. In the NPL, I watch very often the youth games. 12-year-old boys, 15-year-old boys are told, you are a striker, you are a center back. This shouldn't exist at all.
You talk about that, and I'm going back a little bit now, a few years before the glory was actually having players in the NPL competitions at lower ages. But there was a player playing in the State League who then got a chance to play with Glory Youth, and then he was also playing, I think, was at school. Now, he was being used differently in all of those and got very confused as a 17, 18-year-old, because he was like, well, how do I play? And is there an issue between, say, young teenagers that are playing at school that are then coming into your clubs? How do you get that balance right?
Yes, there is an issue. We have the school competition, especially the PSA here, has a huge influence. They occupy the Saturday morning, which is an issue for NPL and State League. They, from my perspective, as far as I saw last year's finals and so on, they play on a very low level, because the better players have no competition over the year, and the schools take the players out of the training session. So there is less need for the better players to go to the limit, and that is something. To play competitive between 14 and 18 is crucial. If you learn that it is enough to do 80% of your ability over a long period of 1, 2, 3 years, you are very, very much in danger to lose the quality to go to the limit later on when it's needed. So I think the school competition is overrated in the way it is. I'm a big supporter of school competition and school development, because that was the start how Germany in 2000 changed around from the position they had in the 90s to that where they are now. But these schools understand that they produce players and support the clubs and are not in competition with the clubs. I think that's a major stuff, that the schools understand that they can provide 2 times extra training, and with the game even a third unit per week, but they shouldn't see themselves in competition. You can see, when we as UWA Netherlands, but it's the same in other clubs, when we give players away with 15, 16 years playing first team in the school, and they return with 17, 18, they drop. As simple as it is.
It's a difficult one, isn't it, as well? Because I've spoken to other coaches who, again, have got children in their squads at those age groups that you mentioned, and they're training at school, they're playing matches at school, then they're going to some of the private academies to try and polish up their skills, and then they're coming to their NPL or State League clubs, and the players are actually exhausted as well as, you know, confused.
The exhaustion is something where I think the main part is that the three groups don't coordinate. They are all thinking they are the superstars. And I listen to school coaches, I listen to private academies, and they tell me, I made these players when he got a trial somewhere overseas. This is ridiculous. Coaches don't make players. Players make players. And coaches help them on the right way. But if you think you're so important as a coach, as a school, or as a club, then you lose what it is really about, that we're helping players. People even forget that 11 players don't need a coach. Football goes on without coaching. So the structure of coaching and the understanding of the coaching is, I help them to get better in the part of their life where they train with me, instead of, this is my player. There's no possession of a player. But when you listen here to a lot of things which happen, they are caused by this ego of coaches.
We've talked about how UWA Netherlands has really made progress in the last 12 months. What are the goals looking forward? And I mean, are you looking to get into the NPL and be challenging at the top in, say, 2 years' time?
I would lie if I would say that it's not our target, of course. Michael is ambitious as a coach, and the players are now ambitious. We have now a players group which leads the first team, and all these players are young, very young. We have a very young leading group of 23, 24 years, so they have a couple of years to come, even to get better. We have very young players between 18 and 20 playing already first team. So everything we did when we started 1.5 years ago with the club was meant to have a 3 to 5 year plan. And if the club continues letting us do what we're doing, then our plan is, of course, to win the league. And why not? In the end, you have the target to get the best out of it. This year is too early, because this is the first year where we really start playing, where we have 10, 15, 20 minutes of football in our games on Saturdays.
Just finally, because there is a lot of pressure financially on a lot of the clubs playing on a Saturday, how are you going to cope with that? Because I believe some of them are bleeding really badly in the NPL at the moment. The State League club seems to be a little bit better, and it's been great to see them have initiatives where they've actually opened their gates for free, and we've seen the crowds go up. 600 at the Kingsley game the other day was fantastic.
I can speak for UWA. We simply don't play the payers. Actually, you know that I think that 2 times training is amateur football, whether you call it NPL or whatever name you give it. It's selling a brand for the reason of administration, but as long as players play less than 5 times football a week, it's amateur. So, and even 5 times football a week for a youth player is amateur level, because youth players between 13 and 18 must train 10 times a week to become a professional footballer. Everybody who does less must have huge talent or simply luck. But normally, when you want to develop something towards professional football, then you need 10 sessions per week plus game. And therefore, we don't pay. And all our players know we don't pay. And there were the NPL clubs this year who pinched away players, and they came there for a couple of weeks, made a little bit money per week, per weekend, and so on, and they came back because I said, for this $100, $200, $500, it's not worth going. So we don't pay, so we don't feel the financial pressure. That's as simple as it is. And I think we can change this, and Michael and I offer them to come 5 times a week, and then we look at it differently. But with 5 times a week, we probably have a much, much bit better chance to win the league. But this is a question the players must answer. Here, when I look into NPL, players who talk to me in other functions which I have in my life of going over to Europe, can you help me with trials? And then you ask them how often you train, and they say 2 times. That's not a good answer. That's not a good answer.
Well, Gerhard, good to catch up with you, and we'll watch with interest the progression of UWA Netherlands.
Thank you very much, Ashley, as always.
Hi, I'm Mark Leduca, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show. And that was Gerhard Janssen. And I think, John, he makes some really, really good points in that interview. Now, I will admit Gerhard is a personal friend of mine as well. But I think it's just really interesting, some of the things that he says there. For example, one thing that I know a lot of the clubs are getting upset about at the moment is the schools thing, that there's this battle between getting players for their youth teams. So the FFA and Football West have asked the clubs to develop junior players, but then because those players are developing and they are the strongest players in school teams, schools are now going, hang on a sec, we want you to play in a school match. Although the quality of the football currently amongst the schools is not very good, so there's no real benefit for these players to play at that level, because I've seen footage of some of them. They literally are walking through 5 or 6 players and banging the ball in the back of the net. Some of them are scoring, you know, 4 or 5 goals a game. That doesn't really help their development that much. And I think, as he says there, they need to sit around the table and come up with a plan where they can still play for their schools and have the honour of that, but they are also still available for the clubs that are developing them.
Yeah, I think it's very important that, that there is a presence of football in schools, and it's of a really high standard. I think when I look around just in Perth, and I'm sure it's the same in other cities, not only in Australia but across the globe, that we have a strong hockey system through the private schools competition. The same with rugby union. I mean, there's a strong culture of rugby union amongst the private schools, and that's a pretty tough competition. Same with football, the type we don't talk about. They have a thing called the Alco Cup, and many great players come through that competition. But there are elite competitions that are probably better, those three particular ones that I mentioned, than the outside competition that's available to kids at the same age. So maybe they've got to look at the schools more closely and try and foster an elite competition in the school system. Now, when I was at high school, we didn't play soccer. In fact, soccer as a when we did have a soccer team at Wesley, they played in a competition that was outside of the Public Schools Association that all the other sports played in. Now, I'm sure that's changed. Now, I'm sure the PSA has their own lovely little seven school competition for the soccer kids, and maybe that's one way that Football West and people like Gerhard can look at a model for kids to have a decent competition at school so that they don't have to necessarily be making these decisions about club versus school, and you know, people are happy for them to be playing in a school competition.
I think you're absolutely right. I think there needs to be a competition like that. And I was talking to Ron Smith, you know, who's renowned as one of the best development coaches this country's ever had, and he was saying one of the reasons we are struggling in football at the moment is there's not a meaningful youth competition across Australia anymore. There is nothing there. And so there's nothing for these guys to actually test themselves, see how good they are, and there's meaning in actually winning the competition. So I think what you're saying there is absolutely bang on the money. The one thing that you're seeing, and again, it's very interesting the point you make, is if you look at Australian sport traditionally in schools, it was AFL and cricket were the two main sports because they are the Australian sports. So they've never needed to have a football coach there. But now, of course, the things are changing. And so what you're seeing is a lot of these schools don't have members of staff who are football coaches. So they're in fact employing outside academies to come in and coach, which again, I think that is good because you're calling on that expertise. But at the same time, if those academies then are stopping those players from playing for their clubs because they want to have their best teams, because they want the kudos of winning the school's competition, because that will enhance their academy, which will bring in more people for their academy, then that's wrong. There's something a little bit wrong there. And I have had parents say to me that some of the, not all, some of these academies are tapping up these young players or saying to the parents, little Jimmy needs to come to my academy, we can make him a better player, and then he might get a game in the first team. Now, to me, there's a conflict of interest there. There's a private enterprise within a school, and there should be a little bit of a difference between the two. So it's a bit of a dodgy area. But just going back, I mean, the school I went to, we didn't play football. If we wanted a team, it was the only sport in our school where we had to run the whole thing ourselves. And I was the secretary for 2 years, had to organise fixtures. When we had home fixtures, had to organise catering, the whole lot, pitch marking, everything. That was when we were at school.
What was the name of that Pink Floyd song? Sit down, son, have a cigar, you're going to go far. Shine on your crazy diamond. It's on that album, but you know the song I'm talking about.
I think I do, yeah.
Yeah, you're going to go far, we're going to make you a star and all that, you're never going to die. And that's what a lot of these clinic people, you know, the academies, it's the same deal. Here's your cigar, son, we're going to make you a star. You've got to be careful with these things sometimes.
Anyway, let's move on to your topic.
Oh, very quickly, I would like to talk about revenue sharing. Mainly because I see a great opportunity for me come June 30. I could be in line for an Australian test cap. A lot of us could be in a line for an Australian test cap. I'm prepared to share revenue. I'm prepared to share any money I might make out of being selected to play for Australia with any charity you like to mention, just for the privilege of playing for Australia. Now, don't think that I'm trying to take it out of the test players and the cricketers. They've got serious concerns, and they've got real concerns. I think it's fair to say that, you know, they do have some real concerns. But it's very hard to know what's actually going on, because we're not actually getting any figures. No one's throwing up any figures to us. about how this revenue sharing model works, you know, how it's based, rah rah. So it's a bit difficult to pick a side, so to speak. But what I will say is revenue sharing means not only do you get more if revenue goes up, you get less when revenue goes down. We've seen Channel 9 announce that they lose money off their cricket coverage. We've seen Channel 10 lose money off their cricket coverage. CA, Cricket Australia, lost $30 million on the Big Bash, which I find staggering. I'd love to see the numbers on that particular bit, because that just strikes me as being crazy. But if it's true, if they have lost that money, are the cricketers concerned that they might end up worse off? Is there an argument for just a flat pay to flat rate of pay for them? Should they just be, you know, arguing for a given amount of money, and if CA has a bad year, well, tough pickies, you're going to have to stump it up.
But if you look at it, that was the model that was around years ago, that they got so much per test and then they got bonuses for winning and whatever. Now, the thing I think that the players are probably not taking into account with this is the cost of sending them on a tour. Like, you know, if they go to England for an Ashes tour and they're away for 2 months and they're not staying in, like, four-star hotels, they're staying at top-of-the-range hotels. Sure, there are sponsorship deals with some of those hotels, but there are still costs, because I can tell you now, a lot of these hotels, they may sponsor them and give them the bed and a room to have, because they get the kudos of having the Australian cricket team stay there, but meals have to be paid for, because you can't, someone has to pay for the meal somewhere, and the hotel isn't going to pick that up. So there
and
are
there's
costs.
Nothing like a markup on food, is there?
No, and we know that all of the hotels do that when they give away their rooms. But so there are costs, and as you say, and I just think sometimes the players are maybe a little bit naive as to what the costs are, but I also think the administrators are at fault for not necessarily sometimes sharing that advice so that the players are more aware of what it costs to send them away. You know, how much they pay on an airfare, how much they pay for excess baggage, because, you know, a cricketer taking his cricket kit, they will have to pay excess baggage on that. You know, so there are other costs there. And the other thing I would like to say with this revenue sharing is okay, let's say we want to do this revenue sharing and you've got a player, and I'm not going to be using exact numbers, but let's just be hypothetical. A player here gets signed for $1 million to play in the IPL. This is a player that was developed through the AIS Australian Cricket Program. Now, is that player going to share some of that revenue back to the AIS? Now, you know, this is something I've been very strong on for a long time, because I think that once you get above a certain income as a top international sportsman and you've come through any of those AIS programs, to me, you should have to give 2% back or 3% back over a period of time.
Well, to the player's credit, they are trying to look after those people underneath them. It's not about what the top stars are earning in this particular debate. It's about, you know, the overall spread of money to all cricketers, which, you know, is problematic.
And therefore what I'm saying should be top of their list.
Absolutely. If you're signed to one of these revenue sharing deals with Cricket Australia, well, you're not playing in the IPL, mate. You're not traversing around the world making 100 grand here, 150 there, 300 here. You're contracted to us and you will abide by what we tell you to do. And that's the way it should be.
Well, that's absolutely right, because if you want to go down that path, you are an asset that is
absolutely a
revenue asset.
Absolutely.
So if you go and play somewhere else and you pull your hamstring and you're out for 3 months, suddenly you have a worker that cannot bring you in revenue or whatever.
Well, the other side of it too is, so that's not a revenue sharing model anymore, friends. When you go off and you pocket that 100 grand or whatever you're making in your overseas cricketing deal, that's not revenue sharing. And the other thing is, we often hear, especially when it comes to broadcast deals and, you know, the salary cap's going to be bigger and, oh, everybody's going to benefit. That's complete rubbish. The only people that benefit from the salary cap being raised are the ones at the top of the game. That's where the money goes from expanded salary caps. It doesn't go to the lowest players in the league. It goes to the top players.
And are those top players also going to share sponsorship deals?
Not a chance. So revenue sharing becomes, as a term, it becomes very problematic. And you've got to give some things a name, that's obvious. But and maybe this is just not quite the correct name to be given it.
No, I think there's a lot more to be played out on that one as well.
Now, can I give a plug before we go?
Of course you can.
because a new hockey podcast will be hitting the airwaves, and by the time this Not the Footy Show goes to air, the first Reverse Stick podcast will be up on the net. Myself and a friend of mine, Matt Allen, are taking on the world of hockey through the internet, and a new podcast. You can find it at thereversestick.net. There's a website there, there's some opinion pieces and the podcast and some other stuff as well on the website, but check it out. It's also Twitter and Facebook, thereversestick.net.
And hopefully on there you'll be promoting Australia's hockey grail.
Oh, we will be promoting Australia. We might even give away a copy or two.
Well, good luck to you. Well done. So the reversestick.net. Make sure if you're a hockey fan, you get on there.
Thanks, mate.
Some people are on the fence. They think it's all over. It is
now. See ya. We'll be back next week.
This one, I'm going to put it up next week, and the hockey world will have started. So.